Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Eloise Sheehan, Jenny Bill, and every so often some delightful guests from the cosmos.
Be kind. Resonance Rewind.
The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle. The Sheer Joy of Mysticism and the Importance of Mysticism in Science Fiction. Just some of the themes which we'll be addressing in the latest Resonance Rewind. It's Deep Space Nine, Emissary.
Thank you.
So the third incarnation of Star Trek on the big screen launched, of course, on the 3rd of January 1993, when it was first transmitted, co-created by Rick Berman, working on the premise that he'd actually put together, obviously is carrying the torch set up by Gene Roddenberry, and of course, the Michael Piller co-creator as well, in a David Carson-directed episode. David Carson, of course, fresh from directing Generations. But what will the team make of it? Well, we're slightly thinner on the grounds than normal in the latest Resonance Rewind. It seems as though it's a case of the time zones have been overlapping and creating challenges. But we can still say welcome to Resonance Rewind, Jenny Bill. How are you, Jenny?
I'm fine, thank you very much. A little bit wet. It's very wet here today in Norway.
Well, so it goes. And Robin Pierce, of course, also online as the co-creator, in many ways, the Michael Piller to my Rick Berman for Resonance Rewind. Robin, how are you?
Well, I thought I was going to be Spock to your Kirk or Starsky to your Hutch. Who knows?
They're all fictional characters, Robin. I thought we'd stick with real-life people. What did you make of... Well, before we actually see, what did you make of it? Would you like to do your usual descriptor of...
That's a kind of a tall order, because this is an epic two-parter to introduce the show. So it does what it needs to of introducing the characters by clever means of flashbacks. But essentially what we have is we have Commander Benjamin Sisko taking command of a deep space station that has recently been vacated by the Cardassians and is in orbit around the planet Bajor, which opens up all sorts of socio-political and religious storylines. They find out that there is actually a wormhole very nearby which can transport them to thousands of light years away. So we have a mixed bunch as a crew. We have shapeshifters. Try telling that one with these teeth. We have Bajoran terrorists, basically freedom fighters, depends which way you look at it. We have somebody who is host to a slug, and we have a couple of familiar faces from the USS Enterprise NCC-1701-D. So this is the beginning, the very beginning. It all takes off from here.
And indeed, it did actually take off and emerge into all sorts of other areas, just as our very own Tear of the Prophet and Prophet Soul, making his debut on Resonance Rewind, can be welcomed to the program. Before we go to Jenny Bill, Phil Leonis, how are you, Phil?
You bring me here.
Exactly. This is the key thing. Perfectly sort of said from that point of view. I feel as though I have not got beyond that point. I exist here. I am here because I exist here. That's where you keep coming back to us from that point of view. Before we turn to Phil Leonis, our ace director in Los Angeles, would you like to share with us your thoughts from Norway, Jenny Bill?
Well... I haven't seen this pilot for decades, and I have to admit that when Star Trek Deep Space Nine first came onto TV, being a massive Star Trek fan, I didn't particularly like it because it wasn't set aboard a spaceship, which I just it didn't sit right with me. But I have to say that I watched this earlier today and I absolutely thoroughly enjoyed it, and I was even crying. I was so involved in it. I thought it was fantastic. It was an hour and a half, but it kept me glued from start to finish. As Robin said, it introduces all the characters really, really well. A little bit of backstory with flashbacks. Great.
I certainly felt it, of all of the pilots for the various incarnations of Star Trek series, the first episodes, it's probably the strongest for me. It sort of touched base on a whole variety of things. And yes, say the incarnations of Avery Brooks as Benjamin Sisko, lots of sort of quality with respect to that. Phil Leonis, we're just opening this whole sequence out. I believe this is something you've got a lot to talk about in terms of Star Trek Deep Space Nine as a director, as somebody who has obviously sort of worked with many of the Trek cast and so on. Share with us your thoughts on this 1993 epic.
I have become aware over the last couple years, and Dean and I have discussed this on our podcast, but really since the early 90s, time travel has been a major growing theme running throughout not just what we consider science fiction, but what we just entertainment in general, and almost always pertaining to time travel surrounding a traumatic event. And so Deep Space Nine, The Emissary, is really at the vanguard of what the next 30 years of entertainment are going to be wrestling with. It's amazing to think that this is almost a decade before 9/11, for example. But a little historic perspective is in order, I think, about this pilot. The reviews were incredibly positive when this came out, but not as Star Trek. As Jenny alluded to, this was considered to be, am I allowed to say this phrase, a bastard stepchild of Star Trek. And even the reviews from the initial pilot were, this isn't Star Trek. However, it might be one of the two best science fiction films ever made. It was evoking comparisons upon its immediate release to 2001: A Space Odyssey. And this wholeheartedly summed up how I felt about it at the time. I became very take it or leave it with Deep Space Nine that first season. I did think that they did an artful job, as Jenny alluded to, of introducing all the characters, something that's very difficult to do, something that in the interesting encounter at Farpoint for Star Trek The Next Generation was somewhat clunky, the maneuvering of introducing all these characters. So it was more artfully done. That said, I think many of us didn't find several of the characters that appealing or interesting to follow at that point. Boy, they certainly did evolve through the years. So there's no question about that. But in a show called Resonance Rewind, I think we do it a disservice in terms of thinking of it just as the pilot for this franchise, for this series, and not to think about that perspective that it truly did tell a standalone story that was worthwhile, that was why we have, in some ways, science fiction, maybe the only genre that can tackle some of these thorny concepts of truly what it means to be human, i.e. our perception of trauma, our perception of time and experience. And it did so in a tremendously artistic, satisfying, emotionally evocative way that truly, I can say now looking back 27 years later, because I, like Jenny, was crying at times, and other times watching with eyes open wide, saying, how did they know this was gonna happen in the world? It's a landmark.
Robin, for somebody who I believe said, oh, at the time, I thought Babylon 5, not another space station series. Have you reviewed the whole sort of sequence in the light of what Phil's quite eloquently shared with us there?
To bring Phil up to date, what I had said previously was, you know, 27 years ago, I this was out and being transmitted in the UK at around the same time as Babylon 5. And I was getting a little bit wasted on dark, dank space stations and socio-political and religious motifs in science fiction. I felt it was all a little bit overwhelming because they were both shown, one was on a Sunday, one was on a Monday, and, you know, basically by Tuesday, I needed counseling. So re-watching Deep Space Nine for the first time since those days, All the Resonance Rewind things that we've rewatched, I mean, like Thunderbirds, Star Trek, Batman, I like those as much now as I did back then. And this is, I think, the first time that I was sitting back thinking, wow, time has really improved this. Either that or my getting older and perhaps, you know, a little remotely, a little bit more mature may have helped it. But I felt keenly at the time, why is it called Star Trek? Trek implies they're going somewhere, and they're not. It's like, you know, for us in the UK, it's like crossroads in outer space. People are just passing through. Of course, they did find a means of going other places. But when you realize the depth of what they were doing and the effects work, I mean, it was so cinematic. You know, the thought that went into it and, you know, a comment on the human condition. And as you say, Phil, what it means to be human, our reactions, our responses, what makes us tick. I mean, it's really a deep and insightful commentary.
It reminds me, it may not have had the overt trek, as you say, the wagon train to the stars idea that that Roddenberry embodied. But when you think about how many great episodes throughout Star Trek were almost those ship in a bottle episodes that didn't go anywhere and yet managed to go boldly where no one had gone before, this certainly fits the bill on that. I think in fairness to how you characterized it at the beginning, it should also historically be noted that there was a great amount of controversy about this with Deep Space Nine, I mean with Babylon 5, because J. Michael Straczynski, the creator of Babylon 5, had been working with Star Trek. And there is a very strong case that can be made that Deep Space Nine was intellectual property stolen from him. And this was very much in the marketplace of ideas at the time that that is what had taken place. And I think there was a certain negative attitude on the parts of certain people towards Deep Space Nine that it was a watered down version in some ways of what J. Michael Straczynski had wanted to do. Again, free from that kind of political context, meaning show business politics, it has a chance to emerge on its own. The other thing that I wanted to say is it's nice when Star Trek, which does envision, hopefully at its best, right, a future that is worth us striving towards, actually is envisioning a show business future worth striving for by telling stories that may be ahead of their time, might run the risk of being better 10, 20 years from now than they are presently. And it was something that many of my favorite artists were doing in the 90s, especially as it applies to time travel. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but there was a film that David Lynch made around the same time called Lost Highway. And it got terrible reviews. And he was fine with the reviews being bad because he said, my aim was to make a movie that comes from 15 years in the future. This is how movies will be made. And it was about time travel. And it did involve time travel surrounding trauma. And sure enough, 10 years later, he makes Mulholland Drive. And it's literally a remake of Lost Highway, only the genders got swapped. And it gets hailed by critics, as if to prove his point that he was ahead of the time. And I think Deep Space Nine was doing very much the same thing. They were ahead of their time. They sensed where things were going. And in some ways they took their cues by doing a little bit of the dark side of the dream proposed by Next Generation. This idea that our explorers will be able to go to space with their families. Family and community will be extended out into space. Won't that be lovely? Well, there were risks and dangers involved in that too. Your loved ones and your family will be in peril. The idea of what community is depends again on your perception, because one person's freedom fighters, the Bajorans, is another person's terrorist. Thorny issues that are nevertheless integral questions to human beings, certainly in the 20th and 21st century.
It is the unknown that defines our existence.
You have the design aesthetic of Deep Space Nine as well, whereas the Enterprise was these smooth curves, wood paneling. It was all rather, you know, luxurious. It was like the inside of a Bentley, wasn't it? Deep Space Nine is more reptilian and, you know, scaly, reflecting the Kardashians, of course. So that
not the Kardashians.
Terrence coziness was taken away.
Did you mean the Kardashians, like Kim Kardashian?
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's no way that I'll believe that they are human.
That's another show for another time and another lawsuit, obviously. But in terms of the sequence there, I mean, I mentioned Eckhart Tolle in the introduction, and I think that very mystical approach to philosophy and actually trauma counselling of actually living in the moment, living in the now, that's something which certainly our lead character, Benjamin Sisko, certainly experienced it. We talked about it when Phil actually joined the programme today, that actually sometimes we do root ourselves in trauma that's existed in the past, that actually that... whether it's death of a loved one, whether it's death of any sort of situation, there seems to be that connection that in terms of time, although we move on, we are the sum of our experiences and so on. I love the line about it is inconceivable that any species can live like this, the sort of playing around with the notion of what is time. And again, the way in which cinema in so many ways is the ideal example of time travel. I mean, what we're doing in Resonance Rewind each week is kind of focusing on the time traveling thing. Jenny, is this too highfalutin? Is this a case of we're just going all for the theories? Or is it just a case of you enjoy it because it's got a really good meaty show line behind it?
I think it's enjoyable because it's, as a standalone, it would just make a fabulous film. I mean, I think it's fantastic. But I also think it does explore lots of interesting things about what we are and our linear existence. And also the talking about the occupation for 60 years of the Cardassians and the way that makes other way it makes people behave, the way the Bajorans are, the way Major Kira is, because she's been fighting her whole life, so she doesn't know any better than to carry on being like that. So I think there's all sorts of things to explore in the episode, outside of it being just a really enjoyable film as well.
Another thing that struck me was Quark's bar. Of course, because you've got Kardashians there, you've got people from all over the cosmos in there. It kind of struck me today, isn't it a lot like Rick's bar in Casablanca? Or have I missed a point?
Phil, is it like Rick's bar? Is Quark's bar Rick's bar?
Robin, I think you're capable of being both right and missing the point. I don't think it has to be either or. That's what this episode teaches us. Everybody comes to Quark's, I think, was even a name of an episode at one point. Though I'm uncomfortable with the comparison to Humphrey Bogart and Quark. Same height, though. But going back to something that Jenny said that I think is really spectacular, this idea of perception being played with, even outside the idea of how we perceive time, but just perception, something that this show is getting at and does both, you know, as above, so below. Here we are in the wormhole, and you have Sisko and Dax in the exact same location, both perceiving it utterly differently. It is a hellscape for one, it is heaven to the other. And this is human nature. It's why the old adage, who can say if anything is good or bad? It's entirely dependent upon one's perception and experience of it. And as if to drive that point home, we do have So Below. We do have the Bajoran landscape. We do have this world that we know all too well of trying to emerge from decades of occupation, of the trauma and the scars of war, and how people who had been unified in opposition to something now are being driven apart by having such wildly different points of view of where do we go from here, based entirely on their perception. And so this concept of as above, so below is so beautifully integrated in this episode without in any way thematically knocking us over the head with it.
I mean, the whole essence of religion. Religio, tying things together, bonding people together on that basis, with the Kaiopaka being, or the character of Kaiopaka seeing as the only unifying force that will actually prevent civil war occurring.
And And if I may, getting back to, again, the thing that makes it Trek in very many different ways, in retrospect anyway, is that it manages to do this. It manages to plumb these rather potentially weighty thematic depths and do it in a way that can speak to all ages. I almost said all languages. Maybe it does that, but speaks to all ages without speaking down to any of them. And that is Star Trek at its best.
It's interesting that for this particular episode, we're all in the second phase of our life experience, shall we say. We've been through the first phase, we're into our second phase, I think it's fair to say, or in the words of another David Carson production, that of the movie Generations, in the words of Picard, maybe we have fewer days ahead of us than we have behind. Although I know Robin and Phil plan to live forever, so that's by the by. Robin, returning to your good self, any characters that stand out for you as being ones that you thought, actually, she's quite interesting, he's quite interesting? Oh, a shapeshifter played by René Auberjonois, the late, great René Auberjonois.
Strange you should mention René Auberjonois. Odo is a favourite character of mine. I love the way that he is both officious, he has a mischievous gleam in his eye, he knows exactly what's going on, does not always let on that he knows what's going on. So he was always a firm favourite of mine. But I may not have been completely fair to Benjamin Sisko when I was first watching it, because I just felt that he was, you know, following in the footsteps of other Starfleet leaders and that we'd seen before, like Kirk and Picard. I thought maybe he was rather too soft-spoken, not authoritative enough. But in rewatching it, I think that Sisko himself may actually be even stronger than Kirk or Picard, because he doesn't do the forceful diplomacy. There's no swagger. He's actually very understated in what he does. And the actor himself makes a lot out of very little in physical. I mean, he is manipulating people, and you know, you've got to have some distance to see that. I think Avery Brooks was a masterclass of acting in this.
He was in this episode a masterclass. You're not wrong to have mixed feelings about him, I think, especially in the season that follows. He was an awkward fit at times, and by his own admission, he was awkward casting. He was someone who did not believe that humankind, Avery Brooks, had a bright, shiny future. And yet he was someone, because he had recently become a father, was determined to fake that belief until he could make it. And I think that makes him sometimes kind of awkward casting. And yet doesn't that very nature of needing to fake it till you make it fit perfectly Sisko's path in this particular episode?
Exactly, yes.
Also, Odo, René Auberjonois, one of my favorite things about this, and to talk about René Auberjonois, who I love, obviously, in this for Star Trek. I love him in his work early on in his career with Robert Altman. And I love the fact that René Auberjonois was someone in real life who was always smiling, always joking, always free and ready with just a full-bodied laugh and expression of joy. And here he is playing a character so perfectly that almost seems to never experience joy. He's almost joyless. And it's such an important thing for filmmakers to understand, for casting people to understand. If you want someone who is utterly humorless, if you want someone who is utterly without joy, you cast actors for whom joy and humor are part of their everyday communication as they walk through the world, because only they understand the value of it and what it means to strip that away.
Well, Odo could have so easily have become a Spock cipher, couldn't he, really? He could have been the Spock or the Data for the third series, but he wisely strayed away from that. And as you rightly say, Phil, the actor himself was so full of joy. It works well within that kind of repressed character, because it's in the eyes. You can see he is repressing something that he wants to burst out, but he can't.
It's it breathes life into it. It's why, you know, if you're playing someone who is depressed, the actor must not be depressed. They need to enliven that. We can see performances about characters who are the most boring people imaginable, and yet we're riveted by that performance of someone playing a boring person. And this is why we can take such joy and humor out of a character that is seemingly dour and humorless, because the actor embodying him has such depth.
Jenny, let's redress the gender balance a little bit. Let's talk about Nana Visitor as Major Kira Nerys, and of course the Terry Farrell character as Jadzia Dax. How did you feel they kind of slotted into the ensemble?
They slotted in very well, because Major Kira is a personality from the get-go, really, from the moment she comes in.
You are throwing it all away, all of it. Hello.
We said before, when they said to him, have you met a Bajoran, whatever grade she is? And and you can hear her in the background already. And they introduced that character, and, you know, but she had that character. I mean, I know, having watched Deep Space Nine, how all the characters evolve and how they change and that sort of thing. I thought the character of Dax, I was never that keen. I mean, I didn't dislike it, but I never really felt it quite worked for me. It was probably one of the characters I liked the least on the Deep Space Nine series was Jadzia Dax.
Unlike, of course, Dr. Bashir, of course, played by Alexander Siddig, or indeed Siddig al-Basil, who...
The men will all disagree with me, of course.
Phil, any thoughts on Terry Farrell's incarnation of Jadzia Dax?
Well, I was going to go with Nana Visitor first, with Major Kira. If that character didn't work, if we didn't believe that character, I don't think we believe the setup. Honestly, we might still follow it because we're Star Trek fans. We might find Avery Brooks attractive or strong, or, you know, but we don't believe the setup if we don't believe her. She is so much our in to the realities of Bajor and the station. And this young woman brings such a world weariness to her that we believe it. And, I think her theater background, you know, she's always been quite the acclaimed and successful stage actress. And I think she really brought to bear the importance of physically embodying that world weariness, so that the moment we see her, we believe it. And it's a critical linchpin to the success of everything.
And of course, it could have been Michelle Forbes Ensign Rowe who could have actually been taking up that occupation, but she didn't.
Right. Well, and I forget exactly why. I think did it have to do with the makeup, with the torture?
She didn't want to commit to 6 years. She didn't want
or
to
seven.
Do 6 years. Or seven, or however many it was, no. But they made it in Bajor, I believe, for her, for that character of Ensign Rowe. Then the actress didn't actually want to do it.
Right.
Just as well, right. She wasn't off at NCIS 16, 17 years and still going strong. But what the hey, that's another show for another time. Robin, we're coming to the conclusion of this particular segment from that point of view. Are any particular additional things you'd like to raise at this moment?
Just, I think it was underestimated, the power of the performance of Terry Farrell as Jadzia Dax, because what you've got there is a young actress playing essentially a very old man. You know, that's how Sisko knew her. And anybody not seeing the pilot would have been a little bit confused that they caught up with episode 2 or 3, where this sort of gorgeous sort of officer walks onto the bridge and Sisko turns around and says, "Good morning, old man, how are you?" You know, but she did such a good job. I mean, again, it was acting more or less with the eyes, that the actress's eyes had more wisdom than one would expect of somebody of that age, if you catch my drift.
She would speak often, Terry Farrell, about the challenges in those early days to handle the technical jargon that the writers increasingly loved to give in Star Trek, right? As opposed to the old days of Scotty, when he would just use colloquialisms. They gave them hardcore technical jargon that the actors did not understand. And she would express this, that it was very difficult. And she had the benefit, as you're pointing out, of getting to play an old man. That was where her focus went. Not on how do I take this jargon and pretend I understand it, or how do I make the jargon interesting? No, the challenge was, how do I play an old man? And it roots, it grounds again the reality of the character in a profound way, rather than leaving her cast adrift to try to make sense of all this technical exposition that can be so thankless.
And of course, in addition to Patrick Stewart, who we haven't even discussed as yet in terms of his line and incarnation in the role, we've got Alexander Siddig, again, another British actor, and Cole Meaney, who again, as Miles O'Brien, I think opened up a whole range of other bits and pieces. Jenny, I hate doing this, but I'm going to come to you first. Marks out of 10. Do we move the former Cardassian, not Kardashian, Cardassian ship closer to the wormhole, away from the wormhole? What are you going to score it on in terms of marks out of 10 for yourself?
Before I give my score, I'm just going to say one thing. The thing that really, once I started watching Deep Space Nine, that I enjoyed was the interaction between Quark and Odo that developed. And actually, they were talking about Odo, but he managed to be give a lot of humour without meaning to. That, for me, was a really strong theme that they developed in the series. Anyway, I'm going to give it 9 out of 10.
9 out of 10 for yourself. Robin?
That's a good score from me.
It is a good score from you. And I will actually duplicate that score with a 9 out of 10.
Phil?
Are we at the end? Is this
we
the
are
end
indeed. This is the end, unless, of course, we return into the wormhole and we go through that whole process. Although I will give you another option in a few moments. I will say at this stage, though, just preempting Phil possibly, I'm going to go for a 10 for this one. I think actually it merits a 10 for me.
The two things that I really want to just underscore about maybe why, if we can say any television program, any movie is important, why this one is important. The way that it shows us that time travel is possible, it is possible as a trek within, that we can go back to our moments of trauma, that we can heal those moments of trauma, and that if you do that, you do nothing less than rewriting your own history. Everything changes, and that hellscape becomes a heaven, potentially. And the other element that I think makes it important that can be forgotten, ironically, in the universe of Star Trek, is that that trek, that quest, is not ultimately to find answers. That quest is to seek out better questions.
Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Jenny Bill, and Alex Lefchuk, travelling across the decades to consider the impact of popular cult TV and film on the universe.
For the first time in the history of Resonance Rewind, we have actually found it. There's more stuff that we can actually allocate in terms of one part. So we're actually having a second part of our consideration of Emissary with, of course, the Deep Space Nine opening episode to the fore there. And we welcome back for this second part of our consideration of Deep Space Nine Emissary, of course, Robin Pierce. How are you, Robin, since we last spoke?
Hello again.
A few moments ago. Jenny is also back with us. Jenny Bill, are you well?
I am. I'm thrilled to be back. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. And of course, Phil Leonis, who's making his debut on what is now going to go down in the annals of time and history as being the first two-parter of Resonance Rewind, considering Deep Space Nine and so on. We've just given our scores. We may still be joined by another Resonance Rewinder soul who might be joining us if they read their emails and so on and responses. But I think it's fair to say that this is a high-scoring production. And Phil, we were also sharing with yourself about the characters and the ways in which these characters were portrayed and working through that. Of course, we haven't also mentioned young Max Grodinchik, who sadly, rather like René Auberjonois, no longer with us. But again, another person who went through a huge character arc, but still impacts with Armin Shimerman, of course, as the Ferengi.
You know, it's an interesting, by the way, nobody got to hear that I gave it a 10 out of 10, a 9 out of 10 back then, but a 10 out of 10 now. One can only imagine how much higher it will go 20 years from now.
We'll do another show back then.
Yeah, back then?
Back then, we're playing with time.
Oh, that's true, we will. We'll go back, oh my goodness. By then, Resonance Rewind will literally go back in time to watch it live as it aired for the first time on January 3rd.
We can revisit our own history.
So Robin Pierce has lost his mind and we're talking about the cast. And yes, something that really, I think probably by Deep Space Nine, had become almost a truism, which is if you want to find great acting in Star Trek, you gravitate immediately towards the characters with the most prosthetics on them, the most makeup. I mean, even going back to Spock, right? This was true. Not that there aren't other great actors, but boy, the actors that played in this case, you're saying Quark and Nog, they had to be really good and really grounded in the reality of their characters to be able to convey everything that needed to be conveyed. I always thought that given the ensemble that Deep Space Nine became, awkward maybe at times early on, but just this multifaceted acting ensemble by the end of its run, that I was always disappointed Deep Space Nine never got revisited actually as a mini series. It could have been on the vanguard of what television in the US would become, which it had long been in the UK, of course, which was the limited run series.
Well, speaking of limited runs, we're delighted to say that although one of our Resonance Rewinders, Eloise Sheehan, is currently on a film set in Surrey, we can welcome back after one or two curious sort of connection problems. Jessica Burt is from North Carolina. Jessica, good to connect with your good self. I won't review the entire part of the first part of this first ever two-parter Resonance Rewind, because we're going to jump straight to your good self. Obviously a relative Star Trek novice, but you've been gradually working your way through this. This is the first time we've put you into Star Trek Deep Space Nine. The floor is now yours, Jessica, to share your thoughts on the episode Emissary.
Hello, yes. Sorry, I was lost in space for a little bit, but I'm back.
It was the last 2 weeks we were lost in space. What the hey?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a bit different from, you know, the original episodes of Star Trek I had been watching before. So it was really interesting getting to see something new that was still in the whole realm. I really liked it. I want to keep watching more of the whole series. That was my thought while I was watching it. I thought the world building was very beautiful. I love getting to see that like lore incorporated into it.
Certainly, one of the things we were talking about in the first part was the notion of perception and the way in which Jadzia Dax sees a perfect planet, an ideal, an idyllic summer's day, basically. Benjamin Sisko, because he's rooted in the past, sees the negative side of things. And Phil, I mean, just praising your own sort of take on the whole sort of sequence. I mean, I think it's fair to say you were maybe just a few years, in fact, we were all probably when we first saw Deep Space Nine, just not close to Jessica's age from that point of view. I mean, any thoughts you'd like to sort of just summarize for Jessica as we get her own thoughts? Because it looks as though it's another thumbs up from Jessica.
Well, I was, as I said, taken by this when it first came out, and it reminded me at the time, it was in a totally different manner, but covering similar philosophical thematic ground as Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris. which was a movie that affected me a great deal. And so even back then, I would have held the pilot of Deep Space Nine up, as I alluded to earlier, as one of the great achievements of feature filmmaking, because it is a feature-length film, of feature filmmaking in science fiction. And what has changed in the 25-plus years since then is now when we are returned to the scene of Sisko's wife dying the second time, and we see him from a different angle being dragged out crying. I am now sobbing with him. I don't think as a man in my early 20s, I could really appreciate the weight of that. Maybe pre-pandemic, maybe even before this year, I would not have been able to appreciate the weight of that. But it is one of the most harrowing, powerful moments I've seen. And it took 25 years for that power to really reveal itself within me.
And I think echoing that point, Phil, I mean, from a personal experience, losing both my parents around about a similar sort of time, that is something where actually, yeah, you do keep going back. You do keep gravitating back. That notion of where you exist in time, and like yourself, it suddenly becomes quite emotionally challenging to actually work through that. Jessica, we've talked about some of the characters, because we haven't actually mentioned Mark Alamo's wonderful Gul Dukat. We haven't really discussed the impact, of course, of Cyric Lufton's incarnation of Jake Sisko. But character-wise, who are your particular favourites? Who were the ones that you kind of thought they're interesting? We've shared thoughts about, obviously, Sisko and other folk, etc. As you've just muted yourself, hopefully you can unmute yourself for this particular response.
Sorry, my mom popped in for a second. I think my favorite character was the main character. I'm struggling to remember his name, but I think what you guys were kind of talking about, his relationship with his wife, I thought that was very moving, and just seeing how much he wanted to be a good father for his son and how he struggled to kind of, you know, unite that between his job and wanting what was best for his kid. I thought that was very interesting to see. And it was very emotional, when, especially when, you know, he saw his wife again on the beach and we got to see how they first met. It was very just moving. I really liked it, and it made him my favorite character.
That almost sounds like a domestic inquiry, of course. Felicia M. Bell, of course, portraying Jennifer Sisko, who, again, does appear in various ways as a series sort of manifests, but in different alternate timelines as well. Phil, you look as though you're about to say something on that point of view.
I had thought about, you know, the nature of trauma. It's one of the things that it does really well, you know, courtesy of the wormhole aliens, but this idea that anything can trigger the return to the trauma. I had an experience earlier today through the Breakfast Club program, where the poet who was the speaker on the Breakfast Club program mentioned the Robert Mitchum film Thunder Road. And immediately I was thrust back to one of my final moments with my father was watching a Robert Mitchum movie. And I had to duck out of the meeting. I can pick a Robert Mitchum movie to watch and it will not affect me. Hearing a Robert Mitchum movie get mentioned by someone else, and I'm thrust back into the moments before my father's death. And so this is the nature of our emotional time travel. We can get removed from the here and now. What I loved in the wormhole was how the wormhole aliens would be voiced and embodied by the characters that inhabited Sisko's life. And it was, to me, a very charming way of revealing that the people in our lives live within us as characters, much as they live out in the world. And yet, the people that live within us might not actually be who they are out in the world. They're who we perceive them to be, and that's who we're carrying with us.
Robin, any thoughts from yourself?
Actually, It's very strange listening to Phil talk articulate so well there about the Robert Mitchum film. I was in a very similar situation a very short while ago, where I had in my hand a DVD of the old submarine movie Run Silent, Run Deep. And the last time I had seen this was, it was playing on a television while I was in the waiting room and my late mother was in the hospital for the last time. She would never come out of the hospital, but we didn't know that at the time. And I had this in my hand and I'm thinking, do I want this? Do I want to take this home? Or do I just put it back and forget that I've ever seen it? So what I did was I took the film. It's currently in storage in one of my boxes in our garage, because one day I will want to see that film again. But right now I don't want to confront those emotions again. And I think Phil would get that. So, it's odd that A, we saw the Battle of Wolf 359 that was famously described, but never seen in the war in the, Best of Both Worlds. This is one of the very few times we saw it. I think they revisited it at the end of Next Generation as well. And the very first time we see Sisko is as he kind of loses command and he actually breaks. So the rest of this entire movie is the rebuilding emotionally and spiritually of Sisko from that point of view. Because our first exposure of him is the man breaks, but the performance is so powerful that we never, ever think of him as weak.
Jenny, you're nodding in agreement there. Presumably, in this sort of expanded version of Resonance Rewind, you'd certainly endorse those sort of things. I'm not going to say, have you had any traumatic experiences you'd like to share? Because it's not a therapy session. Although, if you want to use it as such, by all means, feel free to do so. Anything else that you'd like to add from what you've heard so far?
No, not really, because I already said about the characterisation of Odo and Quark. As I already said, knowing how it went on and developed a lot of the characters and the storylines and the relationships of the people and how the characters changed, and obviously the children grew up because throughout the show, I think it was all really well done. As I say, initially when I saw it, to me it couldn't be Star Trek without the Enterprise, but because now years later I see Deep Space Nine as just as Deep Space Nine, as something, you know, in its own and very good in its own right.
And Jessica, you talked about obviously the character of Avery Brooks, or the actor Avery Brooks portraying Benjamin Sisko. What did you make of any of the other sort of incarnations we saw, and indeed the storyline itself? Did you follow it? Did you think it was useful? Was it emotionally impactful? How did you relate?
I think it was emotionally impactful. I think at parts I struggled to follow along. I think rewatching it will possibly help me kind of understand everything a bit better, maybe read up a bit more on the story. I love to wiki things to understand the whole world better. But no, I thought it was beautifully done.
And all we need is Majel Barrett to be the voice of the computer and all will be well with the world, and we'll connect on that basis. I think we've pretty much developed the sort of conclusion at this particular stage. Jessica, you don't know what the other scores were, unless, of course, you've been back in time and actually listened to the other bits and pieces. So would you like to share with us your particular score out of 10 for Star Trek Deep Space Nine Emissary?
I think I'd give it a 7. I think it's very emotional. And I think it has completely different energy to it than the episodes of Star Trek that I've seen before. This is completely random, but I kept hearing Cardassians as Kardashians. So they're like, oh, the Kardashians have taken over the planet. I'm just like, well, this is amazing. This is hilarious. So that just made me laugh kind of throughout the whole episode, which was not the intention, but.
It might have been. It might have been the intention. That's what I'm saying. This was so ahead of its time. It knew.
It knew.
Our entire culture would be occupied by the Kardashians for decades.
Reptilian dominating.
Yeah, It's a whole new world. Well, I think that, I mean, Phil, I think you have a wonderful visual gag that you wish to actually use, which I'll benefit the listener in terms of where you sort of went through this. Robin, I think you even in the second part of this particular program, you're still sticking with a solid 9 for yourself. Is that right?
I am indeed, yes. Yep.
And Jenny, I think you're on a 7?
Yep, 9.
And Phil?
10. 10 out of 10. But it's liable to go higher as the years go by. Because just like Odo, I am a shapeshifter in search of who I really am.
You were born in the Denorius Belt. And it is the unknown that defines our existence, as indeed Commander Sisko will certainly find out. Worth mentioning, of course, the series itself picked up 4 Primetime Emmy Awards and had another 55 wins and 116 nominations, so well worth accessing. Music by Dennis McCarthy. We haven't really spoken about the music, but again, I think it's worthwhile knowing that the theme was well worth accessing as well. Next week, we go to Shangri-La, as opposed to outer space, so we're seeking the secret of eternal youth, or Frank Capra, of course, in the original 1937 edition of Lost Horizon, before any of us were actually born. So for a change, it's something which emerged into the system before we were actually here, unless, of course, we've been previously reincarnated. So to Jessica Burtis, to Jenny Bill, to Robin Pierce, and to Ace Director and special guest star in the classic Patrick Stewart way for this edition of Resonance Rewind, for Leonis, huge thanks, and keep on resonating.